Now, our overconfidence or arrogance towards Asia, we basically ignore Asia. We don't appreciate oftentimes the people that come from Asia, and in quite a heavy measure also from Europe. I was mentioning at the university's conference that on Sydney Railway Station, Central Railway Station, there's some graffiti, and it says, apathy is our number one problem. And underneath somebody's written, who cares? Well, that's our geography has some influence on our identity. Secondly, our history. Now, Manning Clark, those of you that have studied history know that he's quite a boy. And in 1977, in the ABC Boyer Lectures, he made the statement, all our history seems to sanctify and give prestige to the ownership of property. Ownership of property was the reward promised to convicts. Now, Manning Clark has written some, you know, he's got volumes on Australian history, but there's one volume that's just come out recently, Selections, where not only does he talk about his philosophy of writing Australian history, but he analyses certain contemporary subjects, things like the footy, Ned Kelly, the Labor Party, all those sort of things. So he's a man that's a thinking man. Our man Birch is another, Professor Birch, that is quite a controversial man in our country, is another man whose writings are interesting to read. But our history can be summarised into four waves of migrants that have come to this country. And of course, we are the result from one of these waves. The first wave that came to our country was in 1788 through to 1868, and that are the convicts. 160,000 convicts were transported. There were more convicts than freemen until 1933. The last convict did not die until the 1920s. And so our society for quite some time was static, an authoritarian bureaucracy. And that's a very interesting thing, because in North America, the foundation was settled by high-minded pilgrims. New Zealand had the influence of Presbyterian missionaries. Now, we did have Christian influence from the beginning, but it wasn't strong. The second wave of migrants that came were in the 1800s, and these were often the failures of the old world, who were bent on getting economic gain by coming to Australia. Of course, they went both in the North America direction, in the Australian direction, New Zealand direction, and these migrants were often assisted in coming out. The third wave were the fortune-seeking gold diggers, and by 1878 the population had jumped to 2 million, because there was a great obsession for wealth. By 1900, 1 in 8 Australians were on the gold diggings. So everybody was out there getting his loot. And as we often say, the raison, or the reason for our being, had been established by this point. The fourth wave of migrants came after the Second World War, and these were mostly Europeans, Italians and Greeks, political and economic refugees, about 3 million in fact. And their motives were mixed, partly fleeing from pressure, political pressures in Europe, both the communistic pressures, and also to come out and work hard in a new world where they would get money for their hard work. Now, you and I can go into any milk bar in Sydney, and let me tell you, there's not an Australian that runs a milk bar that I know in Sydney. And the other day I walked into a milk bar and I said, oh, could I, you know, get some eggs? He said, huh? And he just didn't understand me. So I had to say it a few times. We have many new Australians. So these four waves of migrants into our country all came for the purpose of ownership of property and wealth. And so this has influenced our identity. Our identity is based on money, materialism. And this follows on to our third area that influences our identity, and that is our philosophy. Our philosophy is basically to get rich quick. Because it's fascinating to me, having been out of the country for almost 3 years and then to come back, and the first thing that hit me was on the television, everybody said unemployment is up, we're in hard times. It's really difficult in Australia these days. Everybody's discouraged and depressed. The guy that was telling me, we were driving in a 1982 Fairlane, and we pulled in, and next door there was a fellow that just bought a new boat, and I was trying to figure out what he was saying and what I was seeing. It was hard to fit it all together, but there was certainly that spirit was coming over, that we're in hard times. Well, in a sense, we're in hard times, but we're also in pretty good times. I mean, everybody's still living pretty okay. Other nations are grappling with socialism, communism, nationalism. We're grappling with materialism. We're money hunting, and that makes us a very aggressive society, competitive. Jonathan King, in his book on page 49, says the most serious aspect of Australian materialism is the degradation of the mind. The worst sort of bankruptcy is not financial, but spiritual. And this man is not a Christian. Fascinating, isn't it, the insight that he has. He talks about Christmas being a frantic exchange of goods and services combined with the big summer break when there are ample excuses for getting drunk and spending money freely. And I'm sure that Easter will be coming up soon as a good second best. What do we do on Easter? Well, it won't be so much Christ as bunnies and Easter eggs and all this sort of thing. We'll get our focus. Secondly, regarding our identity, firstly I've talked about identity. Now I'm moving on to the second area of five areas, that is keeping our identity or defending it. So I've mentioned three things about our identity: geography, history and philosophy, that really wrap up how we perceive ourselves. Secondly, there's the area of keeping our identity or defending it. And there's about four areas I'd like to mention. The first one is in with regard to the fact of no blacks. We are not interested in the Aborigines having a part in our identity. You say, well, how does that come about? Well, let me mention a couple of thoughts that's reflected in our history. The Bulletin, our magazine of the day, launched a new wave of nationalism when it first published in 1880 by proclaiming on its front, "Australia is for the white man and China is for the Chows." That was across the top of the Bulletin. Well, that's the Chinese situation. And I know that the Asians present will understand. Well, this will sometimes help you understand how Australians think as you're wrestling with the Australian society. In less than 200 years, the Aboriginal population has been reduced from an estimated 300,000 full-bloods to fewer than 30,000 full-bloods. We've knocked out 90% of our Aborigines. I remember when I was in the States, somebody said to me, you know, every country's got a soft spot. You just, everyone loves to push the soft spot. And somebody said to me, oh, what have you done about your Aborigines? Yeah, that's a good soft spot to poke. And my reply was, oh, we've killed them all off. That wasn't the best answer to give, actually. But in some sense, it's true. Whether we like it or not, that's what we've done. The Indians love to poke the soft spot, but they come at it in a more subtle way. They say, who are the original inhabitants of Australia? And of course, what can you say? what's happening to those people today? You know what they're trying to get at. Well, it's true. We have not taken Aborigines seriously. And I know when I was at university, I used to see what I thought all these crackpots roaring off to, you know, New South Wales, to towns and all, to defend the rights of the Aborigines. And I thought, oh, you know, those guys are wasting their time. But they're on issues that were important. And for good reasons. Aborigines were not on any electoral franchise until 1962. They were denied the basic wage until 1966. They were not counted on the census until 1967. They were not represented in any parliament until 1971. There was no Racial Discrimination Act until 1975. The government has spent more on Aborigines in the last 5 years than in the previous 50. And in some of these books that you'll read, they describe the situation in places like Alice Springs, where you've got Aborigines, you know, falling off pavements and in the gutters and all, just on booze and so forth. Well, we have not made any serious attempt at integrating, except with rare exceptions, the Aborigines into our identity. We've kept them at arm's length. We've done the same with the Chinese. And how often have you and I heard in political campaigns about the yellow peril going to invade us from the north? It's fascinating that in 1862, when the Americans were emancipating their black slaves, we were just importing them into Queensland. And we had the Kanakas dying like flies. Over 60,000 of these islanders brought into Queensland found their death between 1862 and 1902. So we have done the same mistake as other countries in these areas. The next area, no blacks, no yellow hordes, and thirdly, no reds. And we often hear the statement that comes, all the reds under the bed. You know, the Labour Party's full of commos. And if we want to tune in to the famous statements that will be heard in the next couple of weeks, the Labour Party is loaded. Trade unions are full of commos. The university is a hotbed for communism. And you and I probably remember the days when to get Mao Tse-tung's little red book, you know, you got your name taken and followed and all the business, all those sort of things. And a statement from one of the books I read said, but most of all, this irrational suspicion has helped keep Australian intellectual life in the dark ages, discrediting opposition to the majority, held view, well, of course, this guy's biased too, but to the majority held view by labelling any radically divergent opinion as communist or communist-inspired. If somebody comes up with a new approach or a socialistic approach, he's immediately designated as a commo. And that's the great way of wiping out your opposition in our country. In India, the great way to wipe out the opposition is say he's working with the CIA. And that wipes out, you know, I mean, who knows what's actually going on, but that's the way to wipe out your opposition. Same way in Australia, you just imply that he's a commo. So Bob Hawke's obviously communist-inspired. We all know that. Well, somebody else has said, an impact greater than any other single political force is this one that's used. We don't raise the Aboriginal issue or the issue of Chinese, but communist is always a good bandwagon to hit. Well, there's other issues. Many people really wrestle with the whole question of the communist question, that we accepted the domino theory and committed our troops to Vietnam. And now many people say, well, is that domino theory correct? So, et cetera, et cetera. In line with that, we have the concept of the Anzacs, men who fought valiantly in the two world wars. And the comments that are often made is that we are quick to defend our situation. And that's right, but it's interesting that in our short history we have joined in 11 major skirmishes and lost nearly 100,000 lives before stopping to ask why. And it's said of us, true or not I don't know, but Australian soldiers have always achieved successes out of all proportion to their numbers. And some people have said, well, we are not plain living and high thinking, we are plain living and hard fighting. So we maybe get into a fight first before we think about it. Another statement is, another paradoxical aspect of Australians' belligerent personality is subservience on which it is based, loyalty to the empire, later replaced by a dependence upon America, is often expressed by a willingness to fight on their behalf, as though the dependent relationship needed to be underwritten by armed conflict. Well, that's a comment. These are not reflecting my views, but I'm reflecting to you how secular people view Australia. So these are some of the things that we have a certain identity, we like it, and we're going to hang on to it. And so that's a fact of our society. The third area that I want to speak on today is, and we're just about to have morning tea, so let me just make a couple of comments here on this third area, establishing material values. I've talked about our identity and defending our identity, and the identity is wrapped up in our materialistic thinking. Now, how do we establish our materialistic values? I think I'll mention about five or six areas. The first one is our city lifestyle. Australians love cities. Now, in Europe, many of the villages grew up around churches and inns. In Australia, they grow up around shopping centres. And our shopping centres are really shopping strips. So the car then becomes important. You know, it's very difficult to get around Sydney on the bus system. And our whole shopping complexes are designed not for people with travelling on buses, but basically people coming in by car. That, of course, city lifestyle has affected the pollution of our beaches. The second area regarded to material values is our class society. The people that have a plume in their mouth. And we often say that we are a classless society. We have a national obsession with the fact that we are classless. But as you and I know, that in fact, we're very class conscious. Just to illustrate to you, one of the books, I think it was McGregor's book, he lists about 25 different class levels in our society. And just to give you an idea, even around Australia, those of you that have been in different cities will recognise this. In Sydney, it's how much money you have. In Melbourne, it's what school you went to. In Adelaide, it's where you live. In Brisbane, it's what church you attend. In Perth, it's your family background. In Hobart, it's how long you've been there. In Canberra, it's your status in the public service hierarchy. So in every city, there are certain values even within a city. But you and I know that we place a high value on where we live, what the age of the car is, the way the place is decorated, the job that I have. Many things influence our status. So we are a classless society that's quite class conscious. Yet during 1977, just picking one year, the Salvation Army provided nearly 500,000 beds to down and outs, and over 1 million meals a year are provided to hungry rejects. We're caring for at least 4,000 senior citizens a year. So there seems to be a bottom end to the classless society. The third level is regarding to a downgrading of spiritual values. And Marcus Sloane, who was the previous Archbishop of Sydney, or the acting Anglican primate at one point, says Australia has become morally bankrupt since the advent of post-war prosperity. This prosperity has created a spirit of secularism and materialism and secular permissiveness. Australia today is a sin-sodden society rivaling ancient Greece or Rome. Heavy stuff. Well, Jonathan King makes an interesting comment that the values of Australians have undoubtedly declined since the early days when hard work and church going was the order of the day. And I found out in Melbourne that in fact some periods of history in the early 1900s in Melbourne, up to 50% of the population was attending church. And I'm sure that was probably true in Sydney, because you and I travel around Sydney, we see a lot of big churches that must have been built to house the people. They obviously weren't built if there are only 10 people going there. But there has been a decline since the early part of this century. He says, respect and for one's fellow man and a strong community conscience was expected in times gone by. Today, these values are considered out of date, an old hat, and looked down upon. It's smarter to call out, bugger you, Jack, I'm all right, and go on your own selfish way. Today, the expectation is more money for less work. Well, I mean, that's his comment, Jonathan King's comment, that there's a the fact that, you know, the first day I think I was back in Sydney, I read on the newspaper that some guy cruised by in a car and just pulled a gun out and shot some fellow in the street for no reason at all. You know, we're in an age of people couldn't care less. Now, that's not true of the bulk of society, but there is an element that's there. Manning Clark also says in 1976 in the ABC Boyer Lectures, "Have we become bored survivors sitting comfortless on Bondi Beach, citizens of the kingdom of nothingness, who booze and surf while waiting for the barbarians?" He and others conclude with the question, "What is an Australian? By what faith does he live?" A couple of other comments to follow on that. The 1977 Gallup poll discovered that nearly a quarter of Australia do not believe in God and nearly one-third do not believe in heaven. We are not a naturally contemplative people and rarely sit down to reflect, think, perceive, feel, and allow ourselves to philosophize. Well, let me stop there. We'll have morning tea. Now let me take one more minute and finish this section. I mentioned downgrading spiritual values. Let me follow on downgrading intellectual values. There's a great brain drain. Now, of course, we know that that happens at every level. There's our young lady, Olivia Newton-John. We've got sports people, golfers, swimmers, athletes going off in different directions. And one writer says, "Until recently, creative individuals facing the great Australian indifference found the only way to gain any respect for their talents was to leave." Well, gasp. I think Ian and I, others would know that in the scientific world, that often is the case. Research and development is on the decline. The problems of change can be formidable, as Australia has always been a very conservative country, despite its image of dash and exuberance. He talks about the question of our education system is often way behind many other parts of the world. 80% of Australians cease education totally after they leave secondary school. Well, that's true in many countries, but it's a factor. There's a complacency about our cultural identity. And many times people feel, well, we're not very cultural. To give you a sense, where do we get our culture from? In Sydney and Melbourne, 400 hours of television shows are shown a week, and the average Australian watches 3 hours a day television. The average Australian spends 10 hours a week tending his garden. That, by the way, is quite important. We'll get back to that. Only 3% patronise the performing arts on a regular basis. Things on television like Number 96, The Box, Division 4, Matlock, Police are watched by a quarter of the public. But 2% of the population watch informative documentaries. Teenagers watch about 4 hours television a day. 52,000 Sydney children watch more than 40 hours television a week. 6,000 Sydney children watch more than 60 hours of television a week. Those poor kids watching all that violence and filth and sex. And so he talks about the downgrading of our intellectual values is a tendency in our society, the Ocker syndrome. So that if you come from Greece or Italy, we don't care about your culture, you become an Ocker like me. Baza McKenzie, our hero, whose humour is often directed at our struggling attempt to create a non-derivative Australian culture. But yet, let me say, to balance that, Australian does have a very respectable record in the arts. We ought not to feel, you know, we're noms. In painting, since World War II, men like William Dobell, Russell Drysdale, Arthur Boyd, Sidney Nolan, all these names are familiar to us, men that are outstanding in the painting world. In music, Dame Nellie Melba, Joan Sutherland, Percy Grainger. Literature, Adam Lindsay Gordon, Henry Lawson. We studied all those bods at school. We have a heritage. Comedians like Barry Humphries, Rolf Harris, actors like Rod Taylor, Peter Finch, Jack Thompson, blah blah, Patrick White, a Nobel Prize winner, and so forth. But our political men, the observers, often feel that when the Labor Party was in previously, there was much freedom given in this area. that our Liberal Party do not see this side as so important. And some of our Liberal commentators, political commentators, say that the Fraser government cuts the funds to the areas of arts and pretty well destroyed the ABC. Well, I don't know if that's totally true, but it may be. Well, many times our cultural identity is reduced to, you know, waltzing Matilda. And if you go somewhere else, people say, oh, can you sing for us waltzing Matilda? You know, they imagine that we're a bunch of bushmen out in the, you know, riding kangaroos and so forth. So this whole ochreism is many times the picture that's painted. Not totally true, but many times that's how even we're perceived elsewhere. Let me stop there and cover the other two areas after morning tea. So let me go to number four, and that is our material gods. Of course, that may seem, what gods are you talking about, but let me see if I can mention six gods in the Australian society. We're in a polytheistic society. The first one is sport. And D.H. Lawrence observed, quote, "Australians play sport as if their lives depended on it. Sport is a lingua franca. Apart from money, it is one of the main features of life that is universally understood by this heterogeneous country of recent arrival." So sport is the thing, isn't it? And it's fascinating to me, coming back, and you just see the changes in that wonderful British sport of cricket. Is now well professionalised and is put into a framework that's far more interesting in my mind. But it's now at a point where we just, cricket is the big thing. The series, whatever series is presently going, and our man Packer's helped all that. But today, it's tune into the Nags, the Dogs and the Footy. And Keith Dunstan, our man from South Australia, has observed in his book, Knockers, "Sport is the ultimate super religion, the one thing every Australian believes in passionately. And then to be a sporting success and to make money out of it is the ultimate in Australian achievement." Well, I think probably our one-day cricket matches and that sort of thing reflect all these things. But certainly, sport for the Australian is a big god. It comes before many other things. And we'll sacrifice a lot of other things to be involved in the footy, even if it's only watching it. We may not commit ourselves to playing it, but we'll certainly commit ourselves to watching it. The second big god is food. Pot bellies. And, you know, we drive around and there's just pot bellies everywhere. I mean, people look bigger and bigger, don't they? And I don't know what it is, affluent society, I guess. Third highest incidence of heart disease in the world, Australia. It is our number one killer, claiming the lives of 54% of Australians. One in six Australians suffer from the effects of high blood pressure. Our life expectancy is 67.7 years. 20% of our society suffers from overweight. One in six Australians suffer from high blood pressure. It's three times more likely to have a stroke than the person with normal blood pressure. Because we have an unusually high ownership in our country, few people walk. You know, we sort of walk from the front door to the car. We do that twice a day. And the affluent also tend to buy lots of food. And these days, you know, people not only have refrigerators, but they have the big deep freeze. You just plunk everything into that once a month, and that's it. We eat and we drink as an expression of our wealth. And I saw last Sunday, I think it was an article in the Sun Herald or somewhere there, that talked about that Australians no longer are focusing on beer, but on wine. That's the thing. Well, that's an indication of affluence. And it says that women are leading the march in this field. Well, Australians are heavy smokers. 41% of the population smoke regularly. Since 1947, the consumption of tobacco smoked in cigarettes has quadrupled from £1 to £4 per head per year. So it's not coming for all those advertisements. It doesn't seem to
cancer and everything else that we're smoking more and more. The third big area that would be a god to us is drink. And alcoholism is fast becoming the all-Australian nightmare. This is Bob Hawke speaking. He should know, shouldn't he? But it's fascinating that for the last 2 years he hasn't touched a drop of liquor, which is interesting. He's still got a pretty short temper, but, he probably is a much better man for it. And Bob Hawke goes on to say, it has created a sick economy where the doctors in charge don't have a clue as to the condition or the cause. Well, it'll be interesting to see what Bob Hawke does if he gets into power on some of these things. 1 in 20 people in Australia is an alcoholic. 250,000 people are considered heavy drinkers, spending an average of $90 a week on alcohol. 83% of men drink alcohol regularly. That probably means that 98% drink here and there. The only boys that don't drink in our society are us guys and a few others. 64% of women drink alcohol regularly. In a recent international survey, Australia was number one. Great news, huh? Other surveys consistently place Australia number two, only to Belgium, the home of European brews. The average Australian drinks more than 46 gallons of beer or liquor a year. And one of the books says, if the impact of drink has been destructive for white Australians, it has been disastrous for black, the Aborigines. And another comment, drinking is deeply important to Australians and its purpose to get drunk is often accepted. The sequence that you and I often know is you get drunk and chunder all over the place and then you have a crashing hangover, and if you can get into a fight, that's the ultimate. Well, I think many of you that have been involved in university sporting teams, when I was playing hockey at the University of New South Wales, I remember a couple of the trips that we took. I think one was to Lithgow, and on the first night the boys all got absolutely stoned and came back and broke every window in the hotel we were staying in, and the police came and moved us all out, and it's total chaos, and this was the ultimate. Another quotation, with cultural values like these, it is no wonder that a special institution is being created to house the circus where men drink and only men drink. Despite the relaxed social mores, the pub is no place for a woman. And another quotation, I think, from Jonathan King, for it is only by drinking that you can prove your manhood in Australia. How many times you and I have been with people, they say, well, he can't hold his liquor. He's not a man. I remember on one occasion with about 200 people involved in the big dinner, and it was after a major sporting event, and the boys go for the boat races. Take the big, cups that are used for the winning cups and fill it full of beer, and if you can drain it in one go, you win the boat race. And they have a garbage tin just next to you, and that's where the guy chunders. I saw one guy and he dropped his false teeth, went into that. Here's this half-sodden dude trying to find his false teeth in all of this stuff. Well, trying to prove our manhood. Well, if you've never been involved with a sporting team and gone through all this, this is some of the experiences that you'll face in the future. You say, well, I'm not called to this. Number four is cars. In the old days, it was the hotted up F.J. Holden. And today, it's still, I couldn't help it. One Sunday, we were driving through the middle of Melbourne on the way to a meeting, and we got on one strip, and boy, just about every second car was hotted up in some way. All these young people going in different directions. And that's one of our gods. 4,000 people are killed per year with a population of 14 million. That's 10 people dying a day. The figures are higher per capita than most other countries. The car has a central position in our society. One in four Australians own a car. That's pretty high, isn't it? And 60% of people drive a car. One third of the nation's households have two plus cars. Every third household has two cars plus. We have the highest rate of car ownership per capita outside the United States, and more than half of our population lists motoring as a major hobby. So what happens on the weekend? You know, everybody, you know, tinkering with the God, getting polished up, shaped up, and ready to be worshipped for the day, and away we go. Well, this is cars. A fifth area is in the area that it's a little difficult to describe, but it relates to a God in the sense of what we'd call the Australian independence, or the Australian toughness, that we are a pioneering nation, that we see ourselves as tough, rugged individuals. And this notion of ourselves can become almost like a God. It can be summed up in the concept of Ned Kelly, of the great statement, "Have a go, you mug." We talked about at the Australian University's deal. That Australians have a tendency to resort to violence, pugnacious and aggressive. We're the wrong types to pick on while drinking at the bar. So as you and I know, when a guy gets a few drinks in him, he's ready for a fight. A tradition of violence, where we place Ned Kelly on a pedestal. I mean, he was just a first-class crook. We see him as a hero. And one of the books it mentions, to many who have studied the problem of violence, is one of the inevitable manifestations of materialism that develops when we've got plenty. Professor Bob Connell, who's a sociologist, feels that many people are under pressure because in order to maintain our standard of living, it puts strain on people, especially at the working class level. And that tends to lead to even outbursts of violence, gang rapes, and these sort of things seem to overflow from that pressure that's put on people. And according to many criminologists in our country, rape is one of Australia's most worrying crimes. It has grown at a fantastic rate, and going back 10 years from now, there were 282 cases. A year later, 680 cases, and it's just gone on and on at a great rate. So many times we see Ned Kelly of the old, modern counterpart today, Darcy Dugan, O'Malley, these sort of people. And one comment is, undercurrent of larrikinism running through Australian society can be traced back to the 19th century. But it's fed. And violence is a million-dollar industry in this country. And you only have to watch the television to see the advertisements of what movies are showing in drive-ins and other places. Total violence. And I saw one the other day. Some deal that was on. It was an R-rated fellow, just loaded full, and they showed about 30 seconds of violence, full blast. You know, mass killings. He says, go and see this at the local drive-in. And so it's a million-dollar industry in this country. And drive-ins, movie theatres, and television scene has changed dramatically. I mean, it's been overwhelming to me just in the television scene that in the last 10 years that violence and open sex is just on the television just like that. And there's no apology, that's just part of what people want these days. And so it's a million-dollar industry that we're not going to curb. And one man has said, such changes would require men of vision who don't have the dollar sign at the center of their thinking. Well, that's part of our society. A sixth God is sex, and I don't think I want to say much on that, but because I think everybody sees enough of it around to know that that's just another God. Well, let me go on to the fifth area, and that's our future. And our future, two things that our commentators say is that we're easygoing and we don't have a vision. Rudyard Kipling said to the Melbourne Press in an interview in 1891, this is what he said about Australians, "You don't know what work is in this part of the world. You don't suppose that this 8 hours work, 8 hours rest, and 8 hours recreation is going to last forever, do you?" So the land of the long weekend. One commentator, "Australia is fast gaining a reputation as a nation of bludgers." Here's another scathing remark which we just have to evaluate. One well-travelled businessman based in Australia told the New York Times in August 76 that the Australian worker produces less for what he's paid than workers anywhere else in Asia except for Bangladesh. Gasp. We have the third highest strike record in the West. November 76, there were 272 national disputes just in that 1 month, of a loss of $5.4 million in wages. Two of our counterparts in the Western world, the United States and Japan, and also Europe, are very concerned about industrial relationships with us because of the problems we face. By the way, I think you probably noticed that over $500 million have just left our country in the last week because of the present political situation. That's very interesting. You know, the economics always flow, indication of our politics. But our Japanese partners in business, our American partners, our European partners, are very concerned about our problems on an industrial level because the work ethic seems to have died. The cultivation of holidays, flexi time and everything else, anything to get more time off seems to be our thrust. In 1977, American businesses had established more than 800 economic enterprises in Australia. Japanese had over 400 economic enterprises. And the two nations that were involved in the Second World War have now been able to take a large piece of the pie. You say, well, is that true? Just to give you an indication of the foreign investment in our country, 90% of our car industry is controlled by overseas, 80% of our oil and mineral, 60% of our non-ferrous metals, 58% of our heavy chemicals, 55% of our tobacco, 40% of our electrical machinery, controlled by overseas investments. The second comment is following on from an easygoing spirit is no vision, and this is summed up in the thought, "She'll be right, sport." And a number of comments here. On the political scene, many people felt that the Whitlam government, when they got in, had a good vision, but they lacked political understanding, to steer a sensible course. They probably introduced too many reforms too fast. That's how some people perceive it. If Bob Hawke does get in, it'll be interesting to see how he goes about things. One commentator says, "Unlike other nations which attempt to set priorities by way of 5 or even 10 year plans, we are content to survive from one financial year to the next, voting in the Conservatives who give us more of the same." Well, anyway, that's what one person says. And just to give you an idea what Professor Charles Birch, who I was mentioning before, argues in a book called Confronting the Future, which is he writes some very interesting things. He says, "What holds us back is not the pressure of reality, but the absence of dreams." How interesting. "And if enough Australians would come to see their present predicament and the possibility of a new way into the future, then we could take the first steps towards that new world." So these are some of the things that come up. I think I'll skip to one final thought that comes up partly to do with the fact that we are often considered a nation of knockers. Why is it that there's a sort of a spirit to knock? I'll give you a classic example of that that came out in my life. When I was in the United States, when I was working with Scotty, the first to... Somebody said to me, "Oh, what do you think of Mr. Nixon?" It was in the middle of the Watergate affair. And I said, "Oh, you mean Tricky Dicky?" And the guy said, "Are you referring to the prisoner?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." Well, I said, "Actually, in Australia, we all know him as Tricky Dicky." I said, "Even when he was a governor, he was pretty tricky." So, but, you know, in our own nation, we're often known as a nation of knockers. And some people have tried to figure that out. Now, people like Conway and King both feel it traces back to our convict roots, that whether we feel that we're a nation born in rejection. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it may be that there are felt needs amongst the unchurched in this area. But I think we have to try to always perceive if people are knocking certain figures in society or certain issues, it's probably a reflection of some felt needs in there. And I think that's a very helpful insight for you and I in trying to perceive how people think. Well, I think many people ask the question, where do we start? And I think for us, we ought to be grappling with the value system of our unchurched friends. We need to give ourselves to prayer. And we need to also go where people are and by faith understand them and reach out to them and lead them to a commitment to Christ. We need to live with the people, move with the people, socialize with the people, and not leave ourselves to random attacks. That I'm in my safe little box and I read my Bible in the morning and then I make a little attack on some non-Christians and then I quickly retreat back into my safe little box. No, I have to actually become part of the society and move with people and live with them and get exposed to them and let them get exposed to me. So the question today, what is my participation level? Is it high or low? Should I belong to an RSL club, a Leagues club, a Rotary club, a Lions club? How much should I get involved in a sports club that's going to involve Saturday afternoon, every Saturday afternoon when I played hockey, Saturday evening, everybody was out down at the pub after the game. I mean, that was just the standard routine. And I was the only guy on our team that didn't drink. Well, how much should I be involved in sports clubs and so forth? What about the question of drinking? How far do I become like the unchurched? Ian mentioned last night that we must become like the people in order to win the people. 1 Corinthians 9, Paul says, "I've become like a Jew." He didn't say, "I have become a Jew." "I've become like a Jew that I might win the Jews." "I've become like those under the law." "I like those without the law that I might win those outside the law." So we have to become like them. But where is the fine line? And the fine line seems to me reflected in Christ, where he says in Romans 8 and the first three verses, and he sums up at the end of verse 3 that Christ was made in the likeness of sinful man, yet without sin. So the border is at the point of sin. If something I'm doing is defined in Scripture as sin, then that I'm over the line. But the problem is that you and I have a real battle knowing how far to get before we get into sin. How far do we actually go to become like people? Because the further we go, the heavier or the stronger the identity. And therefore, in a sense, the easier to draw them out on their felt needs and help them come to Christ. But then we recognize that the closer we go to the cliff, or a better illustration, the closer we get to the gates of hell, the hotter it is. And we have to be just that discerning. Where is the point of sin? Well, just to help you in an area that I believe is important in our society, what about the question of drinking? Because you and I